everybody. My name is Al Caudle. I'm alcoholic. And thank you for the invitation. I spoke here not a long time ago, so if you heard me, you know, a couple of, you know, weeks or 3 weeks ago, you know, I apologize. My story is just the same. I haven't changed my story. So that's a good part. Congratulations to all the celebrants. And how much time do I have? You know, I don't understand this, you know. I'm sorry?
8:45.
Oh, God. I don't know if I can stand that long. Okay, as I said, my name is Al Caudle. I'm alcoholic. I'll give you a little bit of history, my history. I was born in Prague, Czech Republic. And as a young man, I was very, very introverted. I was almost kind of very bashful, you know, I wouldn't talk to people and things like that. But anyhow, I went to a high school in a Franciscan seminary. And cemetery is waiting for me, but you know, Franciscan seminary. And I was born in 1934, so I'll be 76 this year. And I tell the girls I'm 55 and 60, but they're not buying that shit, you know. So here I was, you know, I was in this school in 1950 in Czech Republic, in Czechoslovakia at that time. The communist regime decided to close all the monasteries. So in one night at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, the doors opened, you know, were like three or four guys, you know, in a room. And there was the police, you know, with the machine guns. And they loaded us in the buses and took us in the labor camp. First, you know, they divided the priests and the brothers, you know, and they went to a different place. And us young students, you know, we went as a labor, you know, to a labor camp. So we were building things, you know. I built, you know, half the Czech Republic. You know, we built a dam. And, you know, the sad part about it is our parents didn't know where the hell we were. They didn't have the slightest idea. Okay, so after that, I came out. And, you know, it gives you a little bit of a feeling what communism and socialism is. And so what happened is after I came out, I was arrested again. And the charges were gathering against the state, political reasons. And those days in the 50s, they were actually creating these courts, you know, these sentencing. I was sentenced with 12 other people I never seen them before. Some of them got 15 years, 25 years. You know, I was a youngster and I got 2 years. And the reason I'm saying that, you know, as I come out of the prison 2 years later, I had my first drink. I was in a city and it was, you know, they had a cafe, you know, with the bar, and they were serving booze and beer. And, you know, so I ordered a beer and I ordered a scotch. I don't know what the scotch was. You know, it was some kind of a local brandy. And right away, the same, you know, there was a girl, you know, standing, you know, not too very far from me, you know. And, you know, right after I had that drink, you know, she left. And I would be chasing her on the, you know, around the city in the Wenceslas Square, up and down. And right away I had realized, you know, that alcohol is doing wonderful things for me. You know, I believe that I was an alcoholic before I picked up the first drink. I think I had the alcoholic personality. I had the, whatever you call it, inside. I had the disease inside of me. And alcohol just kind of, you know, started it. So at that point, you know, very shortly after that, after I went to the prison, you know, I was doing all kinds of labor jobs. I was drafted to military. And those days in Czechoslovakia, they had special battalions, special corps for politically unreliable people. So what we had, you know, we had no weapons. We had no weapons, you know, we were just a free labor for the government. You know, what we did, you know, we worked in the coal mines, you know, we worked in the forest, cutting trees. We were building apartments, you know, for the officers. And, you know, we basically represented a free labor, you know, for the government. And, you know, the drinking was very heavy at that time, very heavy. I mean, I drank practically every day. I was in bars, you know, all the time, chasing girls. And I had a motorcycle accident already as a drunk, you know, way back there. And I end up in a hospital for almost three, five weeks, you know. So, you know, alcohol was playing a role right from the beginning. You know, I responded to alcohol, you know, very fast, without any hesitations. I was right in. And very shortly after that, I was in a military service almost a year, if you're going to call it a military service. I was there almost a year, and, you know, I was being hot again. In other words, the government was after me, and I decided I have to escape. The reason I'm giving you this story is because I have so much time, I don't know what to tell you, you know. So I figured I might as well give you a little history. So at that time, I decided I have to leave, you know, so I decided I have to escape. You know, that was not a very easy thing at that time. The borders were completely sealed. They had wires all around the country, three-dimensional wires. It was like a pyramid. They had wires, you know, electric wires, you know, with 3,000 volts electricity, you know, and they had traps, you know, like for animals, you know, you walked. You know, you fell in the trap, and the doors, you know, closed behind you, and they just picked you up in the morning. And they had tunnels, you know, they had tunnels underneath the wires, you know, so they can chase you to the other side. You know, it was a very, very, very difficult to get out. You know, I heard some statistics that, you know, one person out of 500 would ever make it. You know, I was fortunate I did. So I end up in Austria. Through Austria, I went to Germany. And of course, all this time I'm drinking. You know, I don't see I'm having a problem, despite the fact that, you know, I run into some difficulties, you know, with drinking already there. I end up in Germany. I end up working for Radio Free Europe, and that was really something. You know, we had I had a lot of freedom. I received fair, decent pay, and what was happening, you know, many times, you know, I was. Driven from a taxi, with the taxi all the way to the office, directly from the bar, directly to the office, and alcohol was getting worse and worse. So, you know, my story kind of has three parts. You know, one part is the compulsion part. You know, the other part is the first one is the progression. Then it came to compulsion, and the last part of my story is a remorse, tremendous amount of remorse. You know, I hated myself at the end. Okay, so, you know, I'm in Munich in Germany, and drinking practically every day. You know, causing all kinds of problems. You know, to myself. You know, and already then I was wondering, you know, what the hell is the matter with me? You know, we would go to dances, and they have like 14% beer. You know, 14-17% beer, and we would carry a bottle of pure alcohol, you know, and spiking the beer so we can get more out of it, you know. And you know, later I learned that every social drinker does that, you know. And they just do things like that, you know. Anyhow, you know, that is the fundamental difference, you know, between an alcoholic and a social drinker, I think. You know, I mean, you know, right from the scratch. And I mean, in my case, I had difficulties right from the beginning. And I never drank socially. I don't ever recall drinking socially. So I was in Germany, and then the opportunity came up, you know, to emigrate to the United States. So in 1955... I was in Germany, and in 1957, I emigrated to the United States. And, you know, first thing, what happened, I end up in Chicago. And Chicago had, at that time, you know, had very, very strong Czech community. And, you know, if you were in Chicago those years, you know, you wouldn't call yourself Czech. You would call yourself Bohemian. And if somebody asked you where you're from, you said, I'm from Bohemia. And, you know, later on when I went to Washington, D.C., I told them I'm Bohemian. They didn't know what the hell I was talking about. So, you know, I started, telling them I'm from Czech Republic, Czechoslovakia those days. Well, there is a very strong community, and you know, used to be a very strong, Bohemian community. Banks, Czech banks, newspaper, Czech newspaper. Every bar, in that particular area, they spoke Czech, Bohemian, and drinking was unbelievable. I went to every bar, there was. I was the I discovered, that Chicago has bars open 24 hours a day. The syndicate, the mafia owned a lot of the Caesar bars. And that's where I visited, these particular bars. And I had a friend, who used to be a professional soccer player. He was about as big as John, but he was very muscular. He was older than me at that time, and but he was broke also. He was alcoholic, and I still had some money at that time, so I made him my personal bodyguard. And we used to go to bars, sometimes when I talk about this, I shatter, some of the crap he used to do, we went to, the north side of Chicago, these bars, and he would go, and there was lines of people, they were not even able to get close to the bar, he would just shove them over, and I go there like important person, but the problem, the problem was, we used to go, I used to drive him to the racetracks. And several times I forgot him there. And it was like 40 miles outside of Chicago, And, I come home and the next day I wonder, what the hell is this guy? What happened to him, And then people told me, when I was in the bar, they said, what the hell you did to him, he's here looking for you, he wants to kill you. this is what happened. One day, I used to work for the company was making tractors, International Harvester. And I worked for them for a little while, and I was laid off just before Christmas. So we had a party, there was like four or five guys in my apartment, I was married at this time, and four or five guys in the apartment, and, I'm laid off, and I said, we said, well, what the hell are we going to do, I said, well, let's start some business. So we started in a business for ourselves, and we had an eye on a gasoline station. And in those days, it was very inexpensive. It was not a big name. It was just a, small gasoline station. But it had a shop, and my partner was a body and fender man. And what happened is, we didn't have any money, of course, but I went through all these people, and I said, listen, we're buying the service station, and we got so much money. We need only $500, and if you give us lend us $500, we're able to buy the service station. So what happened? They people gave us the $500, and go to 10 people, you get $5,000, and on and on. So we're able to get the money together. But the problem was, the service station was right on the corner. We had a pretty large lot, and there was a tavern right on the corner, and. What was happening? I didn't know absolutely nothing about cars. I didn't know where to put the gas in the car. I didn't have the slightest idea. The first car came on the driveway. Those days the gas was 32 cents, and 32 cents, and you had to wash the windows and check the oils and do everything else. And I was running around the car looking for the gas tank. And but what happened? A lot of times, I would end up in that bar. And my partner, Paul, poor guy, I had to make amends to him. I did, years back. I had to, he was working on a body car. He was working on a car and a body. He had to get out and get me from the bar, half drunk, And, the people, wanted to, by this time I knew a little bit about the cars. And they saw me coming out of the tavern, and I'm staggering around, and they just chased me away. They had nothing to do with me. They just drove off, So that was at that point, describing how my alcoholism was progressing and getting worse. Very shortly after that, I sold that my portion of that service station to my partner Paul, and I bought a coin-operated laundry. Those days, it was very early in the game, and kind of a very new product, you know, coin-operated laundry. And the advantage was that you didn't have to be there; it was a self-service. Okay. And I had 30 washers, and I had 8 dryers, and I had Coke machine, an ice cream machine, and everything else. And they had these little keys, you know, for it was a Westinghouse equipment. And the coin box was underneath the machine. So if you wanted money out of that, you know, and they give you one key for maybe 3 or 4 machines, you know, in case you lose it, so that, you know, the somebody will not pick up, you know, all the machines. So what you had to do, you had to bend, you know, and if you're drunk, it's not easy. You have to bend, and you have to open up the damn thing, and pull out the box, and maybe there was 20 cents in there, you know. And, you know, so for first, well, the first thing what I did, I would hit the dryers because they were easy to, you know, to do. I would go to the bar, and I'm running out of money, so the next thing I do, I go to a dryer, try to get some money out of the dryer. Well, that was not a problem. The problem was when you're in a bar, and you have to pay a bill, and you have a bulge of dimes in your pocket, and you have to pay $20 bills, you know. And some people did object to it. You know, I mean, it took quite a while, you know, to count that money and things like that. So my disease was progressing, and what was happening there, you know, we had a guy, mechanic, and we had a tow truck. And I favored one of the syndicate places in Cicero. And, you know, I would be there, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning. I'd be there 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock in the morning drinking and, you know, running out of money. So 8 o'clock in the morning, I would call Paul and I said, Paul, I need some money. So he would send a tow truck, you know, with Mike to get me some money, which was great. But, you know, I kind of, you know, went forward, you know, years in advance. I'm sober now. I'm in Wilmington, Delaware, and I'm calling Paul, you know, to make amends. And, you know, I call him up. This is like years later. And I, you know, call him. I said, Paul, this is Al. And, you know, he's quiet. You know, he doesn't answer. He's afraid that I'm going to, you know, ask him, you know, to asking for money. And he knew that I was in Washington, D.C. He didn't know that I was in Wilmington, Delaware. And he just stopped for a minute and said, you're crazy if you think I'm going to send a tow truck to Washington, D.C. You're out of your mind. So, you know, it's like a forward. You know, I just thought of that little story. So Mike would come to the bar, you know, bring me some money. And things like that would happen, you know, would happen on a regular basis. You know, I mean, my alcoholism was progressing and getting worse. You know, we decided to move to Washington, D.C. area, you know, I remember Sandy from that area. And so, you know, I'm in Washington, D.C., and, you know, people will ask my wife. And I'm married now, and I have three children at this point. And when I was a newlywed back in Chicago, you're probably familiar with the fire escape. You know, fire escape is in the back of the building. It's a kind of a, you know, like a wooden, you know, I mean, metal stairs coming down in the old buildings. And, you know, I was just married, you know, maybe a couple, 3 weeks. And what happened is, you know, I needed to go drink. So I was creating this story. You know, I would drink beer with dinner in the evening, thinking that I go to bed, my wife is going to fall to sleep, I'm going to sneak out and go down the fire escape and go to the bar, you know, and I'm going to come back, you know, and if she questions my smell from my booze, I'm going to say, well, don't you remember, you know, I was drinking, you know, with the dinner last night, I had some beers with last night. So, you know, right away, you know, those kind of preparations, you know, we make in order for, you know, for us to drink. Okay, so now I'm in Washington, D.C., and, God, another half an hour. So you're going to have to come up, John, and fill it in. So I'm in Washington, D.C., and I'm drinking more and more. My progression, you know, alcoholism is getting worse and worse. And what is happening at this point, I'm getting very lonely. I'm feeling, you know, I'm drinking, you know, by myself. You know, I work in an organization where, you know, we're a sales organization. And this guy, the manager of this office, you know, when I first came in, pointed to a fellow. He says, do you see this guy in there, you know, sitting in that, you know? I said, yeah. He says, stay away from him. I says, what's the problem? He says, he's a very bad alcoholic. You have nothing to do with him. Of course, we became best friends. And the reason is because he was single. He had an apartment, and I was able to go to him, when the bars closed. And, you know, that was one of the things my wife was making comments about, you know, when they asked her, why is it that you moved from Chicago to Washington, D.C.? She said, well, they close bars at 2 o'clock in Washington, D.C. That's why we came here, you know. I mean, stupid things like that. Well, you know, in Chicago, I met this priest. You know, he was a missionary in Africa, and he has seen so much devastation, so many problems, and so many very, very bad situations. But he didn't met me yet. And so we met, and, you know, I would talk to him about booze, and I would talk to him about alcoholism, and, you know, things like that, you know. And one day he asked me, he says, Al, how is your drinking coming along? And I say, well, it's not too bad. You know, I'm keeping it like 2-3 days apart. And he says, you're such an asshole. Why don't you go to professionals? Why don't you go to AA? And he planted a seed. You know, this guy way back planted a seed. Okay. So, you know, I'm here. I'm going to tell you this little story, you know, but this guy. Still from Chicago. What was happening when I was in the bar and I'm drinking, you know, and I feel lonely. I want to cry and beer, you know, as they say. You know, I want to feel sorry for myself. So I would call him up. I would call him up at 1 o'clock in the morning, you know. The guy didn't have a car. He had to wake somebody else, you know. And I would insist that he comes and talks to me. So he would ask me, where the hell you are, you know, where are you at? And I told him the name of the tavern, name of the bar. And he says, okay, I'll wake up this guy and I'm going to come and see you. So as soon as I hang up the phone, I went to another bar so he couldn't find me. And shit like that, it's unbelievable. You know, what we are capable of doing, you know, just to protect our, you know, protect the booze, you know. Well, going back to D.C., my alcoholism was progressing, you know, and I'm starting to feel that there is maybe something wrong with me. So I'm trying to control my drinking, you know, and that is a very, very devastating thing to do. That's a very dangerous thing to do, you know, to try to control your drinking without AA. It's unbelievable. And I would succeed maybe at 10 days. I would succeed a week, you know, and I would think, my gee, I got it, you know, maybe I'm out of this. And I actually would create a plan. I had a little card, and I had it in my side pocket, and it says, how to stop drinking. As I said, every social drinker does that, you know, carries a card in his pocket, how to stop drinking. And I would have points in there, like exercise, develop a hobby, go to church, you know, meditate, you know, and all kinds of stuff, you know. A lot of times I would last, you know, maybe a week, you know. And, you know, then I fell right into it. So I was fighting with alcoholism at that time very, very strongly, trying not to get worse, you know, trying to stop, and I couldn't do it. Actually, I was trying to stop for about 8 or 10 years, and I couldn't do it. I could stop maybe for a week, 10 days, a few days, and that's about it. And, you know, went right back to it, and the progression continued. So here I am in Washington, D.C., and I have a, fairly responsible job, you know, not too much at this point. But, you know, I was making so-so money. I have three children. and I could care less, you know, what happening. And I was training other salespeople, and we would go to this banquet, and you know, I'm standing in a circle of other people, and there is this there are the wives standing on the side, the wives of the new salespeople, and they're saying things like, I mean, do they really have to drink that much? You know, and you know, somebody would answer, well, as soon as they go through the training, they don't have to drink, you know. Well, the point was, I was looking at that time for companionship. And I would go to the salesperson and I would say, hey, you had such a great job. He probably didn't sell anything. You had such a great job. I want to take you out for dinner. Well, the reason was, you know, I needed somebody to kick me off to start drinking, because I was so ashamed of myself already that if I take him out for dinner, I have the first drink, I'm clear and clear, you know, and there is no problem for me to continue drinking after that. But the problem with that was to get rid of him after that, because, you know, I wanted to drink the way I drink, not the way, you know, he drinks, you know, a couple of drinks, you know, and that kind of a thing. I want to drink until oblivion. Well, so that was one problem with this. The other situations, you know, which was creating, you know, which was happening to me was I didn't want to be myself. I hated myself. I hated who I was, who I become. So, and I was lonely. I was trying to get attention from other people. So I had a bar, you know, where I had this tangerine, and they had, you know, a couple, three guys playing different instruments, and they had steins, huge steins of beer, and they had all peanuts. They serve you peanuts and everything else. And they had nice, good-looking waitresses. And I wanted to get some attentions from them. So what I did, I created and I play a blind man. I figured, that's really, you know, I mean, unbelievable. But I did that. I would have a cane. I would put my glasses on and walking around like this, you know, just unbelievable. Okay, and then another bar I had. When you accomplish certain things, you know, in the business I was in, they give you a special business card, and the business card had the big letters with the gold on it, President's Club. You know, that was as a result of some kind of an accomplishment. Okay. So what I did, you know, I enjoyed belly dancers. So I went to the bars, you know, the deli belly dancers. And there was this lady, this girl, and I tear off that part from the business card, you know, where it says President's Club, and kind of lay it around to Angel Aunt, you know, so she can pick it up and she can see it. And she was wondering, you know, what the hell is this guy, President's Club? Well, I was President's Club of the corporation, not the United States, you know. But, you know, I wouldn't tell her that, you know. So I got her pretty much confused and screwed up, you know. And she really believed that I was a secret agent. And one time I come in a place, and she pointed at me. She said, "I saw you on TV with President Johnson." Couldn't believe it, you know. Well, anyhow, even she already knew that there is something wrong with my drinking, you know, because when they come at the last call, I would order double scotch. My drink was JMB and soda, so I would order double scotch, JMB and soda. She would bring it in. And immediately she would bring it in, I order another one. In the last 15 minutes, which is the last call, I probably drank more than most people drink in a month or year, okay? And she really, you know, she was concerned. She said, "Why is it that you're doing this to yourself?" You know, I thought she was, you know, really critical. I was paying for it, you know, so. But anyhow, the waitress was concerned about my drinking. Can you believe that? Well, anyhow. So that was a story with that, you know. And Washington, D.C. was interesting, you know. I spent, you know, a good number of years there, most of my adult life. I sobered up in Washington, D.C. in 1969. I had my last drink. And the way I got into AA was also very, very interesting. I mean, it's not at that time, but it was very interesting. I figured that, you know, I remember that story that priest from Chicago was telling me to go to AA. So I was going to create a situation that I'm going to introduce this Frank, this real alcoholic, I'm going to introduce him to AA. And so I bought a bottle around 1 o'clock in the morning. I end up in his apartment. And, you know, we drank, you know, all night. And around 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning, I forgot what time they opened the central office, you know, quite early. I would call the central office, and, you know, the guy was a newspaper man and on the other end, and he talked to me for a long time. You know, he was asking all kinds of questions, talking to me, and on and on and on and on. And, you know, the son of a bitch changed his mind, you know, by the time I get off the line. He wasn't going to come to AA, so I got stuck with the appointment, and this is how I end up in AA, you know. So it doesn't really matter how we end up in AA, and as long as we end up here, this is the important part. So Frank never did end up in AA, and I did end up in AA, and I started going to meetings, Bethesda, Maryland, and you know, one of my first meeting was speaker meetings, and I actually came in 1968, and the guy who was the free speaker was talking about Ballantine's beer. You know, I don't know, it's from Baltimore or something. They got these circles, and he was making these circles, you know, on the bar, you know, on the stool, and I got so thirsty, you know, when he was finished making the circles, so I went out and got drunk, you know, and, but, you know, my last drink was 1969. So I'm in AA, and, you know, what was very critical for me in AA was the second step. The first step was not necessarily very important to me. The reason, because I knew I was an alcoholic. You know, when I was drinking, occasionally I would end up on a skid row in Chicago. And I would be there for a day or two chasing the prostitutes, you know, three-piece suit, buying champagne to the bumps, you know, and... feeling superior, you know, and I come home. Hello, John. I'll make it somehow. I come home two or three days later, and my wife couldn't believe it. She says, "What the hell is the matter? Are you crazy? I mean, look at yourself. How do you behave yourself? This is unbelievable." And I would tell her with no hesitation. I was just, what the hell you expect? I'm an alcoholic. I'm supposed to be like this. I'm supposed to be drinking. Alcoholics do drink. So when I came into AA, being an alcoholic was not a news for me. You know, I knew that I was an alcoholic. Actually, I was worse off coming into AA than before. Because before I was just an alcoholic, now I was a powerless alcoholic. But, so I was powerless over alcohol, and I was powerless, unmanageable alcoholic. So I was worse off. So, you know, the first step, you know, is very important, extremely important. It opens up the door to the healing process. But to me, the healing started with the second step, believing that I can get restored to healthy thinking, believing that I can stop lying to myself, believing that I will see truth about my alcoholism disease, you know. That is the second step. And that really saved my life. My sponsor kind of introduced me to that. Because, you know, I had questions about, you know, all kinds of things. I had questions about everything. So, I'm in AA. I'm sober. I'm running a business. I'm doing fairly well financially. And I was able to retire at my age 57, which is, you know, by itself, you know, a miracle. I was driving around the Beltway, Washington, D.C., 10 minutes. Okay. Wow. I'll make it somehow. So what happened is I'm running around the Beltway. Washington, D.C. has a Beltway. It's the highway which goes around the city. You can drive there for 25 years and you get nowhere. And but it kind of, you know, is a, you know, leads you directions to the city. And I'm driving around there thinking about suicide very seriously. I have a tremendous amount of life insurance. And I'm thinking to myself, if I kill myself, you know, my children, my wife, is going to be better off than I am. So I'm coming to the end of my progression, coming to the end, and you know, the problem, my bottom was really remorse. I hated myself. I couldn't stand myself. I tried so many times to stop, and I couldn't do it. Well, I forward again, and I'm in AA, and I'm staying sober. Now I have 20 years sobriety, and communism was in Czech Republic, you know, collapse in 1989, and I go there in 1990, you know, 6 months after the revolution, and there was no AA, you know, so I decided, you know, to start AA in the Czech Republic, and I've been going there every year since. Since 1990, and you know, it was very, very challenging at the first because you know we're talking about communist country. Communism, was, by its nature, is atheistic, atheistic nature. You know, they don't believe in God, and you know the basic of the philosophy is a matter. You know, basic of Christianity and other religions is a spirit. And so that's completely opposite. So the people, a lot of the people there, you know, didn't believe in, you know, in anything. So it was not easy to start. But now these days, you know, we have maybe 1,000 members. And in the beginning, you know, it was very challenging. And many times I drove for 2-3 hours, you know, to go to a city to maybe pick up one guy, you know, one lady, you know, and start a group. And now it's going, you know, it's going pretty well. And as a matter of fact, I'm leaving in the next week. To go there for 3 months. I used to go for 6 months. Now I'm going only for 3 months. I still have about 5 minutes, something like that. Is that correct? Okay, 5 minutes. All right. So, so that's what happened in that's what happened with me. And when I got there, I had 21 years sobriety, and they actually thought I'm from a different planet. They could not believe it that someone it can stay sober, you know, without you know. You know, with, you know, can stay without alcohol, because it's normal to drink. It's normal to drink at lunch. You know, normal to drink. You know, at work. You know, things like that. Well, so I was the odd person. There was only one person in the whole country who had 3 months more than I had at that time, and he was a marathon runner. You know, and he came out of an institution. You know, they have you know 6 month treatment centers, but you know you go to a treatment center and you come out. And 99% of those people drink, you know, in a year or two. Okay, so, you know, because without AA. And those days, you know, the treatment centers did not support us at all whatsoever. Actually, they thought we're becoming a competition to them. Now these days, you know, the treatment centers are actually bringing people to AA meetings. So, you know, we have made a tremendous amount of progress, you know, in there. And I'm very happy that I was able, you know, to help and that I was able, you know, to... you know, to start a groups in the Czech Republic. Okay, so I guess that's about it. You know, you heard enough, and I thank you for your time. My time is up, I understand. Bye.
This is Dr. Bob's last message, delivered at the first International Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous in Cleveland, Ohio in 1950. I get a big thrill out of looking over a vast sea of faces like this, feeling that possibly some small thing I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill when I think that we all have the same problem. We all did the same thing. We all get the same results in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. If you will pardon the injection of a personal note at this time, let me say I have been in bed 5 of the last 7 months, and my strength has not returned as I would like, so my remarks of necessity will be very brief. But there are two or three things that flashed into my mind which will be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind, but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into the words love and service. We understand what love is, and we understand what service is, so let's bear those two things in mind. Let us also remember to guard that erring member, the tongue, and if we must use it, let's use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing, none of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or two, to have done numerous little kind and thoughtful acts on our behalf. So let us never get that degree of smug complacency so that we are not willing to extend or attempt to help with that which has been so beneficial to us. To our less fortunate brothers, thank you very much.